While nearly 3 million Native Americans currently live in the United States, and the country has more than 500 federally recognized indigenous nations, these communities remain among the poorest in the country.
Our next guest, a historian, says that Native Americans have been coerced into a colonial relationship with the United States and continue to suffer under it.
She says we need to start setting the record straight by examining and reframing the accepted American version of Native American history, which is peppered with myths she says need to be debunked.
With us now is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Professor Emerita of Ethnic Studies at California State University, Hayward. Her newest book is called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, you say there's a big knowledge deficit about the real history of Native peoples. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, there's a distortion of Native American history, but my book deals more with the mythology of United States history that's based on an avoidance of dealing with certain aspects of that history, and the primary one being that the United States was born as a settler colonial country, already in the process as settlers under the British, and continuing under the Republic, of eradicating the presence of Native Americans and taking their land. So this book is actually the Native American perspective on the history of the United States. So the main mythologies concerning Native Americans are justifications for a false history of the United States, what I call the origin myth of the United States.
Okay, well, let's start there, the origin myth of the United States. What do you see as being the foundational origin myth of the United States?
Okay, so the origin myth is that the United States was fought a valiant war of national liberation, anti-colonial, that they were being, the colonists were being oppressed by the colonial master, as if they were, you know, Kenya in the 20th century rebelling against Britain. And it's really just the opposite, because basically, they were splitting the empire, making a new empire, the American Empire, and with, you know, the same methods as the British, the continuation. But the British had warred with France over a long period, and the French and Indian War, or the Seven-Year War, that ended in 1754, the British announced a proclamation that prohibited the British settlers from going over the mountain range, the Appalachians, Alleghenies. Many squatters were already there on Native farmland. And so both the French and the British, in their settlement at the Treaty of Paris, agreed that the Ohio country, or all of the rest of the territory east of the Mississippi and the continent, would be Indian country, and would, although it would be under the British, part of it, and then, you know, the French in the north, that there would be no settler colonialism. The settlers, they could do trade, but not have settlements. So for the colonists who were already going there and seizing land directly from the Native people, they were ordered to come back. And British soldiers actually were given orders to go out and, you know, make force people to come back to the 13th. Any of the 13 colonies.
Now, that's one myth that's out there that you're talking about. There's another that seems a little bit of a contradiction, which is one that you say is the perception of the continent being wild and uninhabited when the settlers first arrived here. So how do you square those two?
Well, that's you know, part of the mythology in the settlement. I mean, in the first settlement in Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay Colony, the it was very clear that the and in Virginia too, that there were thousands, you know, tens of thousands of Native people. They're farmers and fishermen, and were resistant to the settlers coming in and trying to take their land and food supplies and making war on them. But there was the myth that started at that time was that this was a God-given right. Especially the Puritans had this worked out, that it was the New Jerusalem, that they were going into the wilderness, and that the savages were filled, were devils. And not only did they have the right to kill them, but an obligation to honor their religion to do so. So they posed these people who were just ordinary farmers and fishermen as devils, and then they could be killed. Once areas were cleared, Native people were removed by warfare, and then later on, as an independent republic in the 1830s, all the Native people, there was ethnic cleansing east of the Mississippi, and they were driven out into Indian territory, which became Oklahoma. After that, the mythology developed that of very few scattered Native people that were not using the land, wasn't being used anyway. They were wasting it. I think it was Teddy Roosevelt said, "Who do these people think they are, you know, camping out for generations when the land could be used?"
And we're going to hold it there and come back to this conversation. We're looking at the history right now of the United States from the perspective of its indigenous peoples, and we'd like to hear from you.
Are there myths about Native peoples in the United States, in the New World, that you'd like to see challenged or debunked? Do you have a question about what might be myth or reality? Are you from a Native American community? What are your thoughts on this topic? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue our conversation with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz after the news.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're exploring America's history from a Native American perspective with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, scholar and author, looking at some of the persistent myths about indigenous people in the United States.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you think that most Americans understand enough about Native American history and understand what our guests would call the real story? What myths are you aware of that you might like to see corrected? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Roxanne, I want to skip around a little and talk a little bit about Abraham Lincoln. Now, he is hailed by a hero, as by many people today. How do you see him when you look at him through the lens of Native American history?
Well, he was called a free soiler. It's the party that he formed, and his, for the planters in the South, large swaths of lands were, of course, taken by force away from these large nations of Native people who farmed and lived in towns. That was done, and they were removed. But in the North, there were still, you know, many, many Native villages and farmland. And there were wars particularly going on in Minnesota to take Native land. Immigrants had been brought in, Scandinavian immigrants, German immigrants, and allowed to go there. But, in fact, there was no agreement with the Native people that they could be there. So they They called the, they requested the army to come in. So this Lincoln's party was wanted to take land for, you know, his constituency were landless farmers who wanted land, so to make land available to them. So the free soil meant stolen free soil. So when during the war itself, wars against Native people continued. The Navajo Nation people were rounded up. Kit Carson, the mercenary in New Mexico, was given an army commander position to do that job. They were force marched into a desert concentration camp where one half of them died of starvation and exposure in the very hot southern New Mexico desert. So that was on Lincoln's order and happened during that time, the most tragic event in Navajo history. And in Minnesota, the Minneconjou Dakota people were fighting for their lives to stay there, and they were deemed by the Lincoln administration to be, well, what we would call, well, terrorists now, but unlawful combatants of, and they were randomly kind of rounded up, whoever they could capture, whatever person, sometimes just a farmer walking down the road. And so there were around 300 of them rounded up, and they were sentenced to hanging, mass hanging. And Lincoln had to give the final order. This is, you know, in federal orders. So he ordered that fewer of them, only a representative amount, you know, a third of them be or less would be hung. So this was the largest mass execution in United States history to today, when these Dakotas, who were then by the army people just picked out at random, you know, without any particular reason. So it was really just killing, you know, terrorizing these Dakota farmers. So that they would leave, you know, they would get out of the territory. So Lincoln was simply continued the same kinds of methods, had the same kind of attitudes as previous presidents. The wars being made against the Apaches and the Navajos and the Dakotas that went along, you know, that happened during the Civil War, hardly ever make it into the into history texts. There's even one occasion in New Mexico when the Confederates also, you know, were fighting for that territory, and they're fighting, the Confederates and the Union armies fighting each other in New Mexico, but there was an occasion where they both started fighting the Apaches on the same side, the Union soldiers and Confederate soldiers on the same side. So for Native Americans, there was little difference between those two forces.
Now, another thread that you talk about is the narrative that Native people died out, that they were dying out, which makes it sound as though there was no catalyst for this. Where does that idea come from?
Well, this is, you know, this is what has come to be called the terminal narrative, that with the recent, and it's been very recent, only with Native American documentation and insistence and going to the United Nations and getting documentation of genocide being committed against Native Americans by government policy and government orders. So now it's fairly accepted, not totally accepted, but it is a commonplace to hear of either ethnic cleansing or genocide that did take place by the United States. But in doing so, they add to this, and from the beginning, you know, also under the British, that it was a kind of passive genocide, that it was a disease, you know, a sort of natural, a natural spreading of disease unintentionally, and for Native people who had no immunity. So there are so many false assumptions and premises within that I try to break it down in the book, of that a pandemic like that, say the bubonic plague in medieval Europe that killed off half the population of Europe, it did not mean that those people did not continue. In fact, the genocide against the Jews did not mean those people did not continue as a people and still continue today. So genocide doesn't mean wiping every single person out. And the diseases certainly didn't do that. So they have other things are played down, like the unrelenting warfare by both irregular forces of militia settlers, like Andrew Jackson, the way he started with it, forming the Tennessee Militia, and they just go out on their own and take land and kill civilians.
I'm gonna jump in here so we can get a caller in on this. Let's take Rick in Grafton. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Good afternoon. So my ancestry settled Green Bay. We were Scottish ancestry, and there's a couple of comments I had. I was I played with and lived with the Oneida Nation, and so I, from a very early age in the 60s, heard the Native American viewpoint, which obviously shocked me as a little boy. I've always felt guilty that my DNA may have had a part in these terrible things done to these wonderful people. And I've got two questions. The first one is it true, and can you say who was more cooperative and respectful? Because I had heard that the Scottish, my ancestors, were very respectful of Native Americans versus the British. That's my first question. Is that a myth, or were we all just as bad? And the second thing is, you know, repeat the book a couple times so I remember. And what can I do now as a generational person to help the Native Americans have a better life and to help them be more valued?
Okay, thank you for your call, Rick. And the book is called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. And we're talking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And Roxanne, what would you like to say to Rick?
Very good questions, Rick. Thank you. It's a mixed. My father's family is also Scott, from Scots background, but Scots Irish. So there were two categories of Scottish people, the Scottish settlers in Northern Ireland who had become a sort of perennial settlers. By then they had been allowed to go over and colonize indigenous Irish land in those brutal wars. And many of those same settlers moved on to the colonies, and they were pretty brutal. Highlanders, Scottish Highlander immigrants were a number of cases of very close relations with the Native people. There was a close affinity. There were some cases of Scottish Highlanders forming militias in the early South, but I think there was an affinity on both sides. There was also intermarriage. For instance, the president of the Cherokee Nation, when the Cherokee Nation was forcibly removed from the South, John Ross himself was was Scottish, who married into the Cherokee Nation, and he's one of a Highlander from a Highlander background, and is still one of the great heroes of the Cherokee people. So you definitely are onto something there.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Roxanne. We've got about a minute left. Would you like to speak to Rick's last question? He'd like to make personal reparations.
Yes. What can be done? I say, you know, look into the treaties and agreements that Native people are demanding be validated. Also, the doctrine of discovery, to, I have a whole chapter in the book on this. This is the colonialist law that still keeps Native people in a colonial condition. And it's based on canon law from the 15th century, but it's inscribed in U.S. constitutional law from the 1830s. So look into those matters, but also the sacred lands that Native people are trying to get returned that were taken outside of treaties. And many of these are national parks or state parks, like the Black Hills of the Lakota Sioux people in South Dakota, the Malpai in New Mexico, the San Francisco Peaks in Arizona, Mount Taylor in and not only are these parks, but they're also being mined for uranium and other. They're being abused, and these are sacred lands for Native people.
And we leave it there. Roxanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Professor Emerita of Ethnic Studies at California State University, Hayward. Her new book is An Indigenous People's History of the United States.